This is where normal comes to die. Mediocrity meets its final demise, and the status quo is unabashedly dismantled. Welcome to Reinvention Radio. Now, here's your host, Steve Ulscher.
All right, welcome to another edition here of Reinvention Radio. I'm Steve Ulscher. Welcome to the all-male review. And actually, this is literally an all-male review because we got four guys in the house hanging around the studio, and we have a special guest who is also a gentleman. And let's actually bring Ash in right now, because Lord knows, before we get too far down the road here, Ash, I'm totally going to butcher your last name. So will you say it first, please?
It's Moria.
Moria. Okay. I was like, I am glad you said it first. I don't know exactly how I was going to pronounce it, but it may not have been Moria. Okay. So thank you for clarifying that. And you've got a really interesting story, but just want to make sure folks know that we got White Way in the house. We got Paul hanging out. What's up, Paul, man?
What's up?
Got back from New York hanging out with the Grateful Dead and John Mayer and the whatnot. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Fun. Thanks for being. And of course, the one and only Dick. What's up, man? Rich O'Tay.
Doing great. That's Richard, long for Dick.
It is. All right. So, Ash, how we doing, my man? Where are you calling in from today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm currently vacationing in Maine, so that's where I'm at the moment.
How does one decide to vacate? Where do you live, like, when you're not vacationing?
I live in Austin, Texas.
Oh, so you just wanted to get out of the heat. So you were like, where can I go in America that is probably going to be like the coldest spot at this particular point in time at the end of June? I'm going from Austin to the top of this country. So you just really wanted to get out of the 120-degree Austin heat, basically.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. You are a smart, smart guy. And based on what I'm to understand, you could do your work pretty much anywhere. So are you actually on vacation, or do you take your work with you?
I try to turn off, but I have, there's work never, you can never escape completely, at least that's my world, but I'm mostly turned off, so I take some of it with me.
Yeah, cool, man. So when you're back in Austin, which, by the way, did you end up in Austin, or were you someplace before and you moved to Austin?
I was someplace before, so my story is a long one. I am born to Indian parents, but grew up in Africa.
Wow.
I've lived in different parts of the U.S. For school and work, but Austin was one of the cities that I ended up picking and ended up staying. So I've been there maybe over 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. So did your family end up in Austin too, or where did they end up?
They moved back to India. So, yeah, it's just me, and now I have a family of my own, so we're there, for the four of us.
Nice. And so give people a little bit of an understanding of where you came from in terms of your business background, because you are, well, I mean, let's call it what it is. I mean, you are the American success story. You created a business, you sold it, you created another business, I believe, and you sold it, and now you're doing other things. So you've exited from two businesses in what most would call a profitable manner, correct?
Sure, yes, yes. So the first one was not the company I started, but I joined in kind of at the ground floor. So it was a telecom startup, and that had a big, big exit. The second one I did start, and that one also had a decent exit. But then I started this third company, which is what I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is really working with and for entrepreneurs. So it's a different kind of a business from my previous ones, which were really opportunistic, profit or opportunity-driven enterprises. This one is more of a kind of giving back, purpose-oriented one.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, there are going to be those who are going to say, well, of course you can do this now because you've been able to kind of put money out of the equation. How do you answer those critics, I mean, who say, yeah, it's easy for you to do what you're doing now because you have money? What do you say to those folks who basically are maybe even a little cynical because they're like, okay, of course you're doing sort of this, I don't know, philanthropic, give back kind of helping thing, as opposed to, maybe doing something more opportunistic? There's always going to be cynics out there who are going to kind of wonder, like, about your, is it a guilt thing? Like, you made so much money, like, you feel like now you've got to give back, or how do you address some of that?
Yeah, no, I guess what I find that if I had found this business first of all, I would have probably done that. But like every entrepreneur, I think you have to go through a journey. So one of the things I talk about are those three stages. The first stage that I ran into was what I call the artist stage. So that's where we just create cool stuff and want everyone to start using it. And that sometimes works, that sometimes doesn't work so well. The second stage for me was the artist have to eat stage as well. So that's mm-hmm. when you get good at business and you try to understand that you are building a business after all, because without a business, you just have a hobby. And the third stage, and this is where I see a lot of entrepreneurs end up to, is that there's something beyond money. And I don't think that you have to have, you know, enough money to get there. Some people get there without a lot of money. But you just find this passion really more about the customers. You know, it's less about money. Money ends up being that side effect. So even with this third company, it's not philanthropic in the sense that I don't care about profit or I don't care about money. It's mm-hmm. a business first and foremost, mm-hmm. but the purpose is a bit different. So that's, mm-hmm. that's how I distinguish between the companies I've been involved with.
Yeah, and so just kind of take us back. The first company, when that exit happened, was that, and you can get, you can skip over this if it's not something you feel comfortable answering, but was that a 5, 6, or 7 type proposition for you figure-wise? On the first one?
So it was an acquisition. Yes, it was a telecom acquisition. It was upwards of $500 million was the acquisition amount.
For you, personally?
For me personally, it was kind of in the, you know, probably in the 6, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 7, early, you know, early, you know, small 7 figures.
Even on the first one, so the one that you didn't start. So there's hope for folks then who don't necessarily want to start a business but want to help them help others who have a business kind of grow it, and that's a pretty substantial exit there. At what point did you figure out that you wanted to actually then be an entrepreneur and start your own thing after that exit? And you were like, holy mother of God, $500 million, I'd like to try to replicate that. I mean, was that kind of the eye-opener for you?
No, so I've had the DNA just kind of in me for a long time. So I did come to the U.S. you know, on a student visa, and so that restricted a lot of things and what I could do on my own. And my first preference was to go start my own business. And I think in retrospect, it was probably, you know, may not have been the brightest idea, because I do feel that you can learn a lot by working for others. And in my case, particularly, I learned a lot of things to avoid, because even this company did not have a clear, you know, ballpark, out of the ballpark winner. We went through 3 products that didn't quite get there. And then the fourth one did. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot that you can learn just by going working for other people. And so I had that with that first company.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also, I mean, most entrepreneurs, especially today with the millennials and so on, most of them have never actually had a real job, right? And so it's kind of hard, I think, to build a real business if you've never actually worked in a real business. I mean, it's like the coaches who create coaching businesses, coaching coaches, and that's like their business of coaching is coaching coaches, and that's their whole business model. It's like this circular sort of like, oh my God, all we're doing is coaching coaches on how to be coaches, and when we never actually had a real business. So from your perspective, working in a real business, it probably opened your eyes to systems and frameworks and other ways of operating that you could never have figured out on your own.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even just dealing with customers. So one of the biggest things that I see startups run into is that they have never sold anything to anyone.
Yeah.
And they just have to learn everything from the ground up, which is a very hard thing to do. So I just feel that, yes, there's so much you can learn just by being there, just through observation, that people should do before starting their own business.
Mm-hmm. And so when you came out of that business after the exit, I assume it was fairly shortly thereafter that you said, hey, let me try to do my own thing. Kind of take us through the genesis of that idea, and then in just a couple of minutes here, give us an understanding of what that journey looked like up until the exit.
Sure. So I kind of described how I call the first stage the artist stage. So as I came out of there, yes, you know, I felt rather bulletproof and felt that I kind of understood certain things. And the idea that I stumbled into was one of the 6 degrees of separation. So the basic idea that we're all connected by other people. And this was pre-social networking. So this was maybe a year before Friendster launched back in 2004. Mm. So we were working on this, and we thought it was the best idea in the world. We couldn't tell anyone because ideas could be stolen so easily. And those were all things I learned along the way that, you know, weren't true. But we spent about a year building our product without telling anyone about it, the stealth mode fallacy, as I call it now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 9 months into it, Friendster launched, and we had the oh crap moment. You know, we now have competition, and so then we, you know, launched shortly after, and we thought we were different because we were building a social network that was going to be completely private. We didn't think anyone would fundamentally share their entire network with strangers, and boy, were we wrong. So that was kind of the big lesson learned there, is that you can be different, but that difference has to matter. And so that was how that company got started. And it took us a couple of years to figure out that that wasn't going to work, and then we pivoted to a different idea, and that one got some traction. So that's where we shifted away from social networking to doing more content and media sharing and found some places for the thing we had built, for this technology we had built, and that's how we found a company that, you know, became profitable and then kind of grew from there.
So what was the name of the original social networking idea, and then what was the name of the content play?
Sure. So the parent company was called Wired Reach, and the product that we first launched was called 6degrees, just named after the 6 degrees of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And when that one kind of didn't go places, we've created another company called, or not another company, but another product called Box Cloud. And that was very much like a Dropbox type of a service, but pre-Dropbox as well. More like a box.net that you find, say, as well. So it was a file and media sharing product, and that was the Box Cloud product that I started. And then along the way, we can go into the transition as I began writing. So I became very interested in the fact that I'd started lots of products along the way, but only a few of them actually got to the success point, but they all looked awesome right in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began looking for a repeatable, I call it meta process, a repeatable series of steps that one can go through, and began kind of writing about it and trying to codify that.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, I ran into...
Yeah, well, let's do this. I definitely want to talk about that process and how you were able to codify it, because there's a lot of really interesting information and detail there that I know is going to help a significant number of current entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs. So we're going to talk more to Ash Maria on Reinvention Radio right after this.
You were born to do one amazing thing, but most people spend a lifetime trying to identify what it is. If you're in a job you don't like or are unemployed, if you're in a state of transition or just can't shake that nagging feeling that you were meant and made to do something extraordinary, the Reinvention Workshop is exactly what you need. Led by award-winning self-help author Steve Ulscher, the Reinvention Workshop will forever change your life. The Reinvention Workshop takes you step by step through Steve's proven formula that is help so many get on the right path and be clear about what they were born to do. Take the first step for realizing the life you deserve and desire by visiting TheReinventionWorkshop.com today. No more delays, no more denial. Reconnect with your true self. Learn to live with purpose and conviction and become who you were born to be. The world is waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Log on to TheReinventionWorkshop.com. That's TheReinventionWorkshop.com.
And now, back to Reinvention Radio. Here's your host, Steve Ulscher.
All right, welcome back here to another edition of Reinvention Radio. Steve Ulscher, Rachel Taywide, Wade Nahesh, and Mary Goulet is on vacation, so it takes three of us to do Mary's job. Which
I'm living vicariously through her right now.
I know, on the beach of Puerto Vallarta and enjoying the pina coladas. And I'm guessing probably in the kitchen, cooking pies with her baby. Just a hunch. All right, wait, let's bring Ash back on. And I swear to God, I need to go to like enunciation school or pronunciation school or something, because it's actually Moriah. And I think I butchered it on the way out. My apologies for that, sir. All right, so before the break, we were talking about the framework and really being able to create that repeatable framework for vetting ideas and just kind of running things through, you know, the ringer a little bit there before actually putting any money or real time, energy, and investment into it. So, Ash, you want to take us through what you discovered?
Yeah, so I guess one of the things that I found is that not all the ideas did work and should work, because good ideas are rare. You have to go through a lot of things that work before the one that will really work surfaces. But what really was bothering me more, though, was the cycle time. So at that point in time, I was putting everything into these ideas and was going all in right from the start. So putting the investment in, bringing on a team, building this product, and then realizing that we had built something that not enough people wanted, in some cases nobody wanted. And so that's when a light bulb went on, is that we were doing this backwards. And so what became kind of my interest is, how can we build a process where we shorten the time to vet ideas before we go all in into them? And so how can we get into that early validation and then kind of double down from there? And so I began writing about these things along the way. There were others that were saying similar things. So Steve Lang from the customer development world Eric Ries from the Lean Startup, and they kind of joined in that conversation and started a blog, which eventually turned into a book, and all this was kind of as a side project. And that's when I began to realize that there was some power in this framework and lots of people where it was hitting a nerve with enough people that I began to think that what if I turned this into a full-time business, sell my previous company, and I was having so much fun doing this that caused that transition. So I sold the Wired Reach company, started a new company called Lean Stack, and that's what I'm doing now. So I'm trying to get the message of this framework out and explain some of the fundamental mistakes that I find entrepreneurs make when they get hit with an idea.
Mm-hmm. And so what are, let me just ask you this, because we have this conversation quite a bit over here in terms of nature versus nurture. Do you think that entrepreneurs can be made, or are they just born and you just can't teach somebody how to do it?
So I think that true entrepreneurs are born, not made. That's my opinion. And someone shared this analogy with me of deep sea fish. So I use that a lot. So I say that entrepreneurs are a lot like deep sea fish. They thrive in kind of the dark, lots of uncertainty, lots of extreme pressure. If you bring deep sea fish to the surface, they're going to die. And vice versa, you take surface fish down, they're going to die in the deep sea.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel that entrepreneurs are born. They have a certain kind of characteristic in their DNA that makes them entrepreneurs. That said, I think entrepreneurial thinking, though, can be taught. And entrepreneurial thinking is just a way of problem solving that if we teach people, they can apply that even to their regular jobs, I believe, and may not become entrepreneurs that are going to quit and start their own businesses. But if they can avoid the millions, if not billions of dollars that are being kind of wasted away in failed projects in large companies and institutions, I think that's still something to strive for.
Yeah, and I really do like the analogy of the deep water fish too, because I just my kids threw have like these little torpedo things, and they try throwing them, you know, they throw them like in the deepest part of our pool, and like it's 13 feet deep at one point, so I got to go like, you know, all the way down head first. I didn't realize that there how much pressure there actually is like at the bottom of that pool. Oh my God!
So are you saying you're not an entrepreneur?
I am evidently not, or at least I'm not a deep water entrepreneur, because I was starting to black out just going down to grab this damn torpedo thing. So I totally get the whole deep water analogy. But let me ask you this, because the first book that you wrote, which was called Running Lean, what was that about? I mean, was this based on the framework?
Yeah. So along the way, I had been, you know, one of those entrepreneurs that thinks the thing we have to do is build an awesome product. So, and that product is usually defined by the solution. So we get hit with an idea, we see a problem, but the thing that I ran into, and I find that lots of people run into this bias, is that we think our solution is all that matters. Build a great solution and the world will beat its path down to you. Now, don't get me wrong, there are certain instances of that happening, but those are the unicorns out there where you kind of stumble into the right problem-solution fit. For most of us mere mortals, you actually have to go searching for the right problem-solution fit. So the first book, Running Lean, was written around this insight that we have to redefine the product of an entrepreneur. It's not just building a great solution, but rather building a working business model. So you have to look at the business model like you would a product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. No, it totally makes sense. Now, Let's do this. Now, I've got a number of ideas. I mean, I'm just like an idea guy. I'm more of, I don't know where this would be. I guess maybe in your three stages, I'm kind of more of the artist, I think, more than the artist that has to eat, because I eat whatever. I mean, if you were listening to the show earlier, I took my kids to McDonald's. I'll just eat. Not that there's anything wrong with McDonald's, don't get me wrong, but, or that there actually is. All right, but here's my question for you. If you have a lot of ideas, like me, and I think I literally think I'm sitting on a billion-dollar idea, and Rich and I have talked about this quite extensively. This is something that I think somebody would just be like, wow, this is a great idea. And I don't know if you know this or not, but I've actually been an entrepreneur for a number of years. I own Liquor.com, so if you like to drink, go check out Liquor.com. Mixology, cocktail culture, the whole nine. And we're looking for a nine-figure exit if you want to buy it. Other than that, you know, it's definitely something that just kind of flows through the mind here all the time, which are just a whole bunch of different ideas. Do you review ideas? Like, if somebody comes to you, do you review ideas in this same way using this repeatable framework? Or how can people use, because evidently, like, over a million people have run through this lean canvas, as you call it.
Yeah.
Is that something that Well, should Rich and I do that? What should we do as far as that goes? And what's your process?
Yeah, so if I kind of take that analogy further of looking at the business model as a product, if we were building something like, say, a house, we don't just start by putting up walls. We have some kind of a sketch or an architectural blueprint, even if it's a one-pager. And that's essentially what the Lean Canvas is all about. It's a one-page business plan or a one-page business model, more accurately describe it. And it really is a bunch of fundamental assumptions around your business, like who is your customer, what problems are you solving, how would you solve it, what channels would you use to test. And so it kind of walks you through, there are 9 boxes, kind of basic building blocks that you use. But what I find is that a lot of people, when they keep their idea in the head, they don't quite see the whole picture. More importantly, when they share the idea with someone else, you will talk about your concept or your solution and kind of miss out on the rest of those business model components. So one of the first exercises, yes, is to get the entrepreneur to spend 20, 30 minutes, take this blank canvas and sketch out their idea and almost look at it like playing with Lego blocks. So it's a very approachable thing, unlike writing a business plan, which takes months and you feel like you have to get an MBA to write one of those things. Mm-hmm. The Lean Canvas, contrast, is much more approachable. But the next most important thing is then to share that canvas with someone else, someone other than yourself, and try to explain it to them while they look at all 9 blocks.
Yeah.
And the conversation that ensues, I guarantee, is going to be a very rich one. Mm-hmm. They'll see what's on paper, they'll see what you're saying, and sometimes there'll be an immediate disconnect right there, and they'll start asking questions, and that helps to further your own thinking about the idea.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting too, because I had like this thought, like I was just gonna share with you that idea, and then I was just like, oh my God, it's like 1995. I'm like you with Friendster and that idea. I don't want to say it. Do you think that that's a problem for most entrepreneurs? Is like they have these great ideas, but they don't actually want to talk about them. And should they still be as concerned as you were back in the 90s about the billion-dollar idea you had?
Yeah, so I think there are 2 things there. I mean, one of them, stealth, absolutely it's a bad approach, simply because without getting the idea out there, you're never going to know if it's going to work. And one of the exercises that we have people do is we tell them, actually try to get an idea stolen. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Ooh.
So obviously keep your best idea to yourself, but take number 2 or number 3 and do everything in your power. Go tell everyone, you know, write to product managers and companies and say, here's an idea, take it, it's free. And you'd be surprised that most people will not see what you see.
Mm-hmm.
So not as easy to actually get an idea stolen. That's the first step. But the second thing I tell people is that we are not out there to go and tell people how to implement an idea. So in these conversations that I'm talking about, if you were talking to a customer, the customer does not care about your solution. So mm-hmm. I'll use a different analogy, the sausage analogy. You know, you might like to eat sausage, but the moment we know how that sausage is made, you may not want to eat it anymore.
Ooh. or where that sausage has been.
Or where it's been, exactly. So the same thing, we entrepreneurs want to, you know, protect our secret sauce, but customers don't care about that. They want to know, what can that do for them? What is the problem you're really solving?
Mm-hmm.
And that you should, and almost definitely from day one, should be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So how about these companies like, well, we'll probably have to do this in the next segment because there's only like 30 seconds left. But like Snapchat, like what are they really solving? Is it another place to go mess around and do things? Now, it seems to be evolving into other things and other companies are going to use it for branding and stuff. But got 30 seconds left, so Steve wants to say some stuff and we'll get your answer after.
No, it's a great question. What is your take on Snapchat? Because they're not really solving any big problems in the world. They're just another fun little place. What's your take on something like that?
Yeah, so in those kind of businesses, we are trying to create attention. So we're trying to create an engaged audience. And the real business model there is that an advertiser will come or someone will come and pay for that happiness of the users.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the history of Snapchat, it really started out by one individual who wanted to really get these pictures out there, and he liked the self-destruct kind of message concept. So it was really a toy like Twitter was.
Yeah.
And found that engagement.
Yeah, exactly. So there's always going to be room for those sort of entertainment-based businesses. And really interesting conversation here with Ash Moria. And we'll be back on Reinvention Radio with Ash right after this.
You were born to do one amazing thing, but most people spend a lifetime trying to identify what it is. If you're in a job you don't like or are unemployed, if you're in a state of transition or just can't shake that nagging feeling that you were meant and made to do something extraordinary, then the Reinvention Workshop is exactly what you need. Led by award-winning self-help author Steve Olscher, the Reinvention Workshop will forever change your life. The Reinvention Workshop takes you step-by-step through Steve's proven formula that has helped so many people get on the right path and clear about what they were born to do. Take the first step to realizing the life you deserve and desire by visiting thereinventionworkshop.com today. No more delays. No more denial. Reconnect with your true self. Learn to live with purpose and conviction and become who you were born to be. The world is waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Log on to thereinventionworkshop.com today. That's thereinventionworkshop.com.
Looking to be a successful entrepreneur? The virtual assistant industry continues to be a top choice for those looking to start their own business. The problem can be how to become a virtual assistant. Many turn to the Bible of the VA industry, the book, Virtual Assistant, the series, and it's the perfect guide for office managers, executive assistants, and other administrative professionals looking to make the transition from employee to successful business owner. Go to vatheseries.com to get your copy today.
And now, back to Reinvention Radio. Here's your host, Steve Olscher.
All right, welcome back to another edition here of Reinvention Radio. Your host, Steve Olscher, hanging out with Richard T. White Wade. Mary Goulet is on vacation. And we're talking to Ashmore Ia. Very interesting conversation. And by the way, if folks want more information about you and the books and those sort of things, leanstack.com is the best place for them to go, or should they go elsewhere?
That's the best place, Steve.
Okay, so leanstack.com is where folks should go, and definitely check out the book there. Now, you've also got, it's Lean Canvas, right? That's another book as well, correct?
No, the new book is scalinglean.com.
Oh, Scaling Lean, yeah.
First Scaling Lean. And then Lean Canvas is the one-page business model.
Right, gotcha. Yeah, which, and by the way, how did you get that? I mean, for those who have online presence and try to do things online, geez, to try to get a million people to download or get on a page or anything, I mean, is quite difficult. I mean, liquor.com, we crush it pretty good, but for the average folk, you know, a million downloads of anything is pretty darn huge. How do you think you were able to get such reach on that? And frankly, is there something that people can do that's repeatable around that in terms of traffic?
I guess if I was to break it down, I would say I found that the more traction, I find that kind of engagement is directly correlated to sharing information along the way. So unlike my previous company, you know, the whole thing about stealth is that I kept that to myself, and you start building that audience the moment you think you're ready, and oftentimes you're ready way before that. So Lean Canvas, the roots of it started out way before the product was even ready, because I was talking about the problem along the way. So when a solution kind of in its early form was out there, people began to engage with it, and then pretty soon with word of mouth, it spread rapidly over the years, and that's kind of why there have been so many people looking back.
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. So you talk about, you know, sharing your second best idea and these sort of things in terms of, like, let's get some feedback and, you know, kind of keep the bigger one maybe to yourself. Let me run something by you here, and I'm just here. This is my second best idea. And Rich, I've talked to you about this one before. Wait, maybe I don't know if you heard this or not. Maybe you have or not. All right, but basically, what the idea here is, you know how, like, Groupon has done really, really well over the years, of course. And being from Chicago, I now live in San Diego, but being from Chicago, got a chance to see that company grow. And Groupon's great. You know, you get 50% off, or you get something like that. But, you know, Ash, what's the one thing that people like more than a discount if they're buying something? Even more than a discount, what do they like in terms of the price point? Even more so than half off. What do you think?
I think one of the things I see with Groupon is that the chasing the discount is often not enough. You have to have a good product to begin with.
Yeah.
So I'd almost say discount plus value.
I could see that. And so what I'm thinking is, like, people love a good discount, don't get me wrong, but what they love even more than a good discount is something for free, right? I mean, it's like, just give it to me for free. So the idea that I had was, and this is going to be like an exercise in entrepreneurial review and see if this passes sort of the framework and vetting an idea here, that sort of thing. And I dare you, somebody out there, to steal this idea, and because I'd love to see it come to fruition, and I'm not sure that I'll have time to do it, but how about this? So the idea was it's something called, like, 3-4-3 or something of that nature, but the idea is we get people like a General Mills or a Pillsbury or a restaurant or a whomever to give people something for free, whatever it is, like $10, a bag of chips, you know, whatever it might be, and in exchange for getting that for free, all they have to do is answer 3 questions. Right. So answer 3 questions and then you give those people your name and email. They have the opportunity to email you at least once. You can unsubscribe at any time. But bottom line is it becomes a data play more than anything else. Right. So people register. So as the owner of the company, you get all of that data. They indicate what they're interested in. You know, we're interested in sports. We're interested in drink. We're interested in vacation, whatever it might be. And then you go to the companies. The companies pay for the reach to hit all of those people and, like, you know, I want to get this in front of 100,000 people. Fine. That's what you pay for. You pay for 100,000 on it. When you get to the 100,000, you pay the company, which would be basically the middleman. That's us. And the consumer answers 3 questions, whatever those 3 questions are that the company provides. They get that data. They get their name and email. They get to hit them at least once. Maybe they stay on their list. Maybe they don't. But that's the general concept. And ultimately, at the end of the day, everybody wins. Consumer gets something for free. Company gets data. They get their name and email. I think it's kind of a win-win-win. What do you think?
Yeah, so I guess one of the things that I often will tell people is that it's not my place to judge an idea simply because there's so many ideas out there that seem, you know, silly or crazy, and then they went on to prove them otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But what the framework is all about is we'll show you a way to go test the idea as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So even in your case, I wouldn't start off with just keeping the idea in your head. You know, find a product that you think has that high demand, and, you know, make this one campaign actually work. And I think it can be, you know, conceptually pulled off very, very quickly. I think within a month you could get enough data there to show if this business could take off or not.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead, Rich.
Since we're talking about Groupon, there's a buddy, Noah Kagan, who you may know, mm-hmm. Also in Austin now. But he started AppSumo kind of all over a weekend. He said, you know, if Groupon is doing this with restaurants, I'm going to do it with products that developers and designers want. And he found a very desirable product, called the owner, got a great deal, and used his email list, and so didn't build anything. You know, now they've got lots of, got a great website and a lot of back-end technology, but this was all built over Google Forms, PayPal, and he launched this over a weekend, proved the model could work, and that's how the company got started.
That was a perfect lead-in. I was actually going to ask you about what came first, the chicken and the egg there in Austin, Texas. All you startups seem to be coming out of there. It's like Silicon Valley or San Francisco of Texas. And Noah is a perfect example. I was going to actually mention, like, that's an example of him doing more or less your model, right, with his jerky, and he did it with a few things.
Exactly. Yeah, and one of his things is to actually challenge, you know, entrepreneurs out there is, you know, without building anything, go validate your business. There's so much infrastructure out there, as I said, within the Google tools, PayPal, and, you know, mm-hmm. take a few other email providers if you need email. You know, you're done. You don't need mm-hmm. anything else.
Mm-hmm. And I hate when we run up against the clock here. But let me ask you this, man: how would you define entrepreneurial thinking? Because I know you have your own take on it. How would you define that?
Yeah, so if I kind of break down the process, so step one is, you know, take the idea out and break it into its component pieces. So that's kind of the blueprint. Step two is to identify what's riskiest in the business. So in a lot of businesses, it's not what we build, but rather that customer market, the business model itself that's risky. So identify what that risky thing is. If it's a behavior change like with Snapchat, build something and see, can you affect that behavior? At AppSumo, you want to make the transaction happen. In your case, with the example you gave, you want to make sure you can connect people with free products, and that will be enough for them to give you data. That's what you want to test, and then there'll be a buyer for that data. So if you can connect those 3 pieces, you are golden. So mm-hmm. to me, that's the critical step, is getting people to think about the riskiest thing, not the easiest thing. And then we talk about time boxing, so fast experiments. So in your case, you know, I would say within a couple of weeks, maybe a month at most, can you come back with a campaign and stack all the odds against you, pick the best product, pick the best thing that you would give away for free, and if that doesn't work, then the harder products are not going to work either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really helpful. And so if you had one final piece of advice, something that you just think every aspiring or, shall we say, fledgling entrepreneur needs to be thinking about, what would you tell them?
So I summarize everything that I've learned over the years with just one line, and that is for people to love the problem and not their solution. And the way I'll just throw out another analogy kind of in at the end here, starting with a solution is a lot like building a key, but you don't quite know what door that's going to open. But if you flip that around and instead go looking for problems, find a customer that you want to serve or find a problem you want to go solve, and you can find the doors you want to open, building the key actually comes easy to us as entrepreneurs, but it's really when we do it in reverse that we run into trouble.
Wow, really, really, really sage advice. So thank you so much for that. And Ash Moria, really do appreciate you coming here on Reinvention Radio and joining us today. Check out Ash's work at leanstack.com, and pretty interesting stuff there, my man. What do you think there, Rich? Yeah, pretty
good.
Yeah, really good. I know, Wade, I know you appreciated that as well.
Oh, I'm going to be applying this.
You're going to be applying this. Get the Lean Canvas, right? Go grab that, man. Very, very, very cool stuff here on Reinvention Radio. We will talk to you guys next time.
You just got dismantled. Thanks for listening to Reinvention Radio. For more information about the show and your host, Steve Olsher, visit reinventionradio.com.